Well, good morning.
Good morning.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Gregory Wilson. We have several new folks here today. I just want to affirm the courage of our religious education director, Carrie, to give six young children sticks within a 10-foot circle. I'm just thinking, all right, Carrie. That was pretty good. If I were to disappear before your eyes, I'm wondering if it's because I have merged matter and antimatter into the sermon today. Atheism and theism. Is that like two categories that come together and repel one another and that really don't have anything in common? That I think would be the common understanding of our culture. And we've seen persecution of atheists in our culture to no doubt. I think there's 11 and 12 states in our culture that you can't run for office if you're an atheist, written on the books. That's persecution. And the other thing is, if you don't believe in God, you can't run for office. That's the other side of that, right? And so you have these two opposing forces that have been traveling with us for quite a number of years. And today, we're going to bring an atheist, the mind of an atheist, and that thinking, to defend Christianity. When I first got a hold of that sentence, I just went, what? Because usually this is a tough fight and persecution, burning at stake historically, all kinds of stuff. But before I do that, I'd like to kind of set the stage, I think, with some information that'll be helpful in doing that. And I'd like to read a quote from this gentleman, Slavoj Žižek, who's a Marxist philosopher from Slovenia. And it's curious because I was reading this one quote and I thought I'd read it to you. It's a guy commenting on atheists, commenting about Christianity and talking about atheists. And I don't know if you've the recent book, Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, he's kind of like on the kind of forefront of atheists standing up for themselves, I guess. And this isn't so complimentary, but in essence, here's what this commentator says. He says, renowned for his much-quoted review of Richard Dawkins, Terry Eagleton, he began with this scathing tirade with this line. Imagine someone holding forth on biology whose only knowledge of the subject is the book on British birds, and you have a rough idea what it feels like to read Richard Dawkins on theology. And I got to thinking, well, that's true. If there's a lot written on theology, and if you haven't really immersed yourself in the subject, it'd be hard to criticize that. But on the other hand, he says about Žižek, an atheist, talking about religion, Christology, and God, that he has immersed himself in theology. And he has some understanding of theology, and that it's a completely different process. And I think, like so often, that when we think of Christianity, sometimes we simply think of what we see on television. We don't think of a fine nuance, a fine study of Christianity. And also the same way when we think of atheism, we might think of atheists who just say there's no God and who are totally isolated from any sense of religion, and there's nothing in between. There's no nuances of understanding and talking. And what we've learned is, at least right here so far, is that there's a vast difference in the realm of Christianity and in the realm of atheism. And I thought I'd read a quote from Žižek to get us started. This is about Žižek. It is vital that everything usually assumed in the Christian reading of Jesus on the cross, since Paul, of course, has to remain in order for Žižek to reach his radical conclusion. As was mentioned earlier, for Žižek, the cross was one of the factors that represented the impotence of God. Therefore, on the advent of Christ's death, the functioning of both the Father and the Son in the Trinity ceased to be. Only the Holy Spirit remains, which naturally for Zizek means the community of believers through whose activity the notion of reincarnation can properly exist. This opens up a community of believers that preserve Christ in the midst of us. For Zizek, this version of atheism is the very supplement necessary to save modern Christianity from doom. What is he saying? Because when we think of religion, we think of God that's powerful. And if you read in any religious, what religion, you think gods are powerful. But here's this man saying, no, if you read this story of Christianity, if you really read it, what the message was that on the cross, out of the Trinity, both God, the Father, and the Son died. Period. It doesn't reveal an all-powerful God. It reveals an impotent God that could not save the Son. And then he says you have the same story in the book of Job, where God and Satan are sitting up in heaven, I guess, having a conversation, which is kind of a curious metaphor anyway. Sitting up there having a conversation, and Satan says, you know, this guy, he just follows you. He's loyal to you because you give him good things. And God says, nah, if he didn't have the good things, he'd still follow me. And Satan says, okay, I would not want to be Job with that conversation going on without my knowledge. Because I would not want that to be coming toward me. But nonetheless, it did. And Job has these three friends come to him and try to tell him all the reasons why these things are being taken from him, and Job's not buying into any of it. And what this Zizek says is that what this is reveals is God couldn't help Job. Now, when we look at history, when we look at the Jewish nation who has this theology, who Zizek is saying of this impotent God, when we look at World War II, how many people say, where was God? God could not save people from the death camp. I don't know if you've read Elie Wiesel, who's written a number of things about the concentration camps, a concentration camp survivor. And there's one story where he tells where they're walking in the camp, and there's these gallows right there, and people were being hung, and it's his person walking with him says, well, where's God? And Elie Wiesel points to the gallows where a child was hanging and says, there's God. There's God. God is impotent for Zizek. God cannot answer all of our questions. And he says, if we do not try to wrap our mind around that and understand that, modern Christianity is doomed. Modern Christianity is doomed. I thought that put a couple other things in mind, because for me, when I'm talking about this, I know that my mind is preset. I've got my understanding of the world, I've got my understanding of religions, I've got my understanding of Christianity, I've got my understanding of atheism, of agnosticism, and how relationships work and how the minds work. In some ways, my mind is set and locked in. And sometimes when I'm hearing a conversation, and I tell you, reading this fellow Zizek, you're going to get some stuff that's accurate and probably some stuff that's not. Because he's hard. He's a philosopher. And in a way now, he's a theologian. He's a sociologist. And it's difficult reading. And I thought it might be helpful to get some understanding how our minds work. Because in a way, our minds got to be loosened up, I think, to really get this. And I was reminded of an experience more than once of working with couples in a counseling process. And a couple comes in and they say, well, we want to change. Something's not working for us. And so we begin to work on changes. And you'll hear this invariably from either one at any given particular point in time. Well, that's not going to happen because they've always done it this way. well, that's not going to happen because they've always done it this way. Right? So what that means is that when they leave there, I'm going to relate to you in such a way that I know you're going to do the very thing that we're trying to change. So I'm going to relate to you, which ultimately has the effect of no change. It's not going to change. And what that means is that even though I say I want change, I relate to you in a particular way that sabotages the change. Our minds are preset. And so I'm going to ask today that we begin to loosen them up. And I thought, and that's kind of a personal example, is first of all, how do I allow my mind to loosen up if I'm working with somebody in relationship and I say we want to change? How do I say I'm going to suspend the past so that the future can be opened? I'm going to suspend everything I have believed about the history, about who I am, about who you are. I'm going to put that on hold so I can attempt to experience the future differently. Now, we live in a culture, and we're doing this in this sermon, and we're trying to do this and try to understand this. However, we are in a culture that has trained our mind as well. And here's the struggle we have in the culture that we live in. And this fellow's called the Illusion of America in a book. And he writes this about our imaginations and in ourselves. And the point I want to make with this, with the same example with a couple and this example too, is that our imaginations become foreclosed. That our imaginations become closed. That we take our history and we project it into the future and we walk into what already exists. We walk into what's already there because I've already projected it into the future. And what Zizek is going to say about Christianity is that Christianity, and is the only religion that he sees, is the only religion that really fights that phenomenon. The foreclosure of the future. And this fellow says, celebrity images in this consumer culture are reflections of our idealized selves sold back to us. Nearly everything we do to enlarge our world, to make life more interesting, more varied, more exciting, more vivid, more fabulous, more promising, in the long run has the opposite effect. In the extravagance of our expectations and in our increasing power, we transform elusive dreams into graspable images within each of us, which in each of us can fit into the images that we create and project into the future. By doing so, we mark the boundaries of our world with a wall of mirrors. Our strenuous and elaborate efforts to enlarge experience have the unintended result of narrowing it. And this is the culture in which we live. That the very thing we want to do, we do the opposite. And one last thing before we get into the heart. This sermon will be a continued sermon to help. Or we'll go to 12:31. No. One last thing to do to kind of help set this up. I have spoken before about Daniel Quinn and what Daniel Quinn does in the story of V. It's a wonderful reading. It's a wonderful way to understand history from 10,000 years ago of how we get here today with a sense of agrarianism and how agrarianism and coordinated and controlled agrarianism has structured our society because we could feed more people and become overpopulated and the difficulties with that. And so he writes that in the years 1400 to 0 BCE, that we have some signs of overpopulation. We have some distresses. We've already got standing armies. It's a funny thing, when I was reading that book, when he was talking about standing armies, he was saying that, well, at one time there was no standing army. But then standing armies came. And I never really thought about that before. He said at one time there was no crime per se, a nation that has a crime theme in it. He said that didn't exist before. He says at one time there was no counterfeiting. That didn't exist before. At one time there was no inflation. That didn't exist before. At one time there was no slaves. That didn't exist before. So how did they come in? How did they come into existence? And in about the years 800 to 600 BCE, he says something came into existence religiously that never existed before. He calls them the salvationist religions. He said people at that time began to really think something was wrong with them. Something inside them was wrong. And that they needed something outside of them to rescue them and save them. And he says that when you look at history, you don't see that particular religious expression or phenomena prior to that. It's just not there. So we have this thing, and he calls them the salvationist religions. Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, different parts of the world. And they all sprang up. I always put Christianity in with the salvationist religions. I just assumed that that was correct. And after reading Zizek, I'm thinking, it may be indeed that Christianity is the statement that salvationist religions did not work, are not working. To expect to be rescued, to expect to be saved, to expect something from outside of yourselves or outside of your local group to come and save you or to rearrange your life so that your life's going to be better for you, he may be saying, as he's interpreting the Christian story, at the death of the Father and the Son on the cross, it's not going to come from outside of you. Not even your God can come down and save the Son off the cross. That's not going to happen, is what he's saying. He doesn't say that ends the story there or that ends the story of the resurrection. He says, no, what's left is the Spirit. And that the Spirit is left. And that where the Spirit is resurrected, where the Spirit comes into play within our individual lives and within our communities in general, it's up to the community to do this external salvation. It's up to you. It's up to us to do this. It's not going to come from the outside. So in his interpretation of Christianity, he's saying yes to the story, but he interprets it differently than we have had it through history. And there are reasons for that, and we'll get into that. But in a sense, he calls us back to ourselves to put it the responsibility for who we are and our communities and the situation we're in back to ourselves. For example, what that would mean in our society. I don't know if any of you remember the Secretary Watts of the Interior? Remember him? And at one meeting, it was quoted in the newspaper, him saying that when every last tree is cut down, Jesus will come back and save us and rapture us.
What a deal.
He said that, right? Okay. Well, in Zizek's interpretation of Christianity, that statement would not exist. His interpretation of Christianity is, take care of the trees. They're your responsibility. This is your earth. You have to take care of it. Nothing's going to happen later on to rearrange your society except what you do. So in a way, his interpretation of Christianity is in our face. You can't depend on somebody else. If you want to read more about him, I mean, he's on the internet and you can get films of him, and he is entertaining to watch. He talks like, we're going to be doing this and this. And, I mean, this just reminds me a bit of, who's the Princeton guy? All the hair. What's his name? The professor of Princeton. Does anybody know?
Cornell.
Yeah, Cornell West. He's a little bit like Cornell West. He's kind of out there, and it's easy to get. You just push in his name, and it comes up, and you'll see what I mean. But he's brilliant, and I think he's helpful, and I think he's on to something that if we're going to save that form of responsibility for selves, that we need that Christian message. But that Christian message has got nothing to do with afterlife, has got nothing to do with, in a way, it doesn't matter, true or not true, of a theistic position. But what he's saying is the message, the story at that particular point in time in history is one of the only stories we really have that can help us and free us in living in an oppressive environment. And I think that's a message we Unitarian Universalists can hear and need to hear, and one, if we can orchestrate it right, one we can repeat out in the community. So I do hope you come back next week to hear the rest of that. Sorry for the time.